thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. Happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.
It is a luxury to have enough of your needs met so that you can focus on art.
Mm-hmm.
And just like you said, I think 90% of people, if they had their needs met, they would. And at the same time, that doesn't make it easy.
Absolutely.
It's still hard.
Like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Step up to the mic to introduce Daisy. That's his name, Paul, Paulo Padakeo.
What? The internet's a wild place, man.
I know. That's like one of their primary complaints about me is the way I move my mouth.
That's so dumb.
I know. So I'm standing in the mirror being like, is it weird? Am I moving it weird? And then I'm like, maybe I'm moving it normal because I'm looking at myself. And I like don't know.
And now you've lost it.
Yeah, so now like I've lost it. So I'm like, I'll just take it. And then people tag me and other people and they're like, this is how you move your mouth. And I'm like, see, that looks normal to me. I don't know. I feel like I'm missing something here.
I heard the conversation about the, maybe I should be saving this for on air. I don't know. But I heard that, what's in my pocket? Ooh, cough drops. I heard the conversation about the horse.
The horse thing?
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah, you saw me talking to yes. Yeah, dude, yeah. Everyone always says I look like a fucking horse.
I was laughing. I was like, that's so silly.
I do look like a different animal more though. Like that's my real beef. Is I'm like, I look like a maned wolf, which sounds cool because it has wolf in the name, but it is not. It's like a weird, very lanky creature.
I'm not familiar with it.
It's super random. It's like a random animal that's endangered in Brazil, but I look exactly like it. So I'm like, if you guys are gonna compare me to something. Compare me to this weird wolf fox thing that looks like it has a connective tissue disorder. Like, that's what I look like, is that thing. Slay. You like your pose? I feel like we look really cute together.
Look at this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a vibe.
It is a vibe. See, our outfits are very complimentary.
Yo.
Y'all looking good, keeping it cash.
Yeah, this is cute.
Back, you know?
Yeah. I'm into it.
All right.
Smooth.
Check levels and then we'll be good to go.
All right, sounds good. And your name is pronounced Tosin, right?
Tosin.
See,
yeah.
That's why I fucking asked, because I was like, I know I'm going to fuck this up because he has Nigerian parents.
Some people give it that Z sound, Tosin.
But it's Tosin.
It's Tosin.
More like Avatar The Last Airbender, where they do the S's instead of the Z's.
Is that what they do on there? I haven't watched Avatar. I've gotten a lot of flack for it. I know
understand.
How much.
Inspired.
I know.
It's so good.
I've watched the first. Of the cartoon. I've watched the first episode and I enjoyed
it. It's a strong pilot.
I'm slow.
You gotta get in there. Once you get into like Zuko, then you're gonna be locked in. Zuko's the best character. He's like a he has the best character arc in animation, I think.
I can't wait.
You would love it as an actor, honestly.
Honestly, everybody has said great things.
It has such round characters. You would really appreciate that. It has like no flat characters except for maybe the Cabbage Man, but he's supposed to be.
His name is the Cabbage Man?
Yeah, all he does is yell, my cabbages. So he's the Cabbage Man.
What's a show without a Cabbage Man?
Exactly, that's my question.
There's
got to
be somebody who just yells random. I love Dragon Ball Z. I love other animes.
Dragon Ball Z is so good.
It's, you know, it's my childhood. It's like 4th through 8th grade.
Yeah, as it should be.
So I expect to like this.
You will like it. If you like Dragon Ball, you'll definitely like it. Everyone who likes Dragon Ball who's seen Avatar likes Avatar.
Mm-hmm. And I hear the new ones ain't shit on the cartoon.
Listen, people are being way too critical of those kids, I think. I think the problem when you adapt anime into like real life is anime is a highly stylized like art style.
Yeah.
And it hasn't been translated into live action well because it's almost impossible.
It's too people are moving too literally.
Yeah.
Too.
It should be treated as like a very loose adaption.
Because
also with cartoons, like the characters don't age in real time. So when it's a show that involves children, you know, you have to have like legally, they can't film year round, nonstop, no days off.
Right.
And they're in like primary growth spurt ages if they're like 12.
So then the story has to.
It has to move faster. So they have to cut out a lot of things and people get upset like, that storyline was so good. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it was really good. That's not why they cut it. It was just too time consuming. And these kids are aging actively.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Is this, are we, is this happening? Is this the interview?
It's been recording.
Oh, has it?
Yeah.
I was just vibing, actually.
I was too, but then it occurred to me in the last one. I was like, wait a second. Is it happening now?
No, I'll have you introduce yourself and stuff so that we can do a little.
Avatar talk is great.
I love Avatar, though.
I love Avatar. It's the best.
It actually is. It's how I started TikTok.
My girl told me we needed to watch it. We started.
She's so right.
I want to see it. I just been busy.
You're going to watch it and you're going to be like Avatar for you need to watch it because your auditions, there's so many good monologue choices
that I could use.
So like you need to watch it just for that. Like there's such like a broad like scope of great monologues.
Speaking of, and that's why I said I like Dragon Ball Z. When I was in middle school, there was a monologue from Dragon Ball Z that I used.
Hell yeah, dude.
Like anime's got some good hefty especially because characters have so much like
the stakes are high
and they have so much baggage.
Yeah.
So much. So like monologuing about entire civilizations being destroyed.
Yeah.
Although when you do that for your eighth grade drama teacher, they're like, this is not particularly relatable to your
life
experience.
They're like, boo. And you're like, actually, it could be. I have a very active inner world. You don't know. You have no idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. All right. We're good. Okay. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Tosin.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here, too. Welcome to Days at Night. Will you give us a little bit of a background on, like, who you are, what you do?
Where do I start?
That's such a good... With, like, in utero, probably.
Yeah, I was 7 pounds, three-fourths. I don't know my height, but I was the smallest of my brothers.
Oh.
I don't know. I'm an actor. I'm a writer. I'm a director, producer. I live in Hollywood, live in North Hollywood to be specific. I spend most of my time acting and some of my time producing and a lot of my time sitting at my laptop writing.
Classic.
Yeah, that's my both my pastime and my major output. And so that's what else can I tell you?
Well, your short films have been really well received so far. I saw impressive stuff.
Thank you. Winning awards.
Thank
you. The last short film that I did has been doing well in the circuit, but it's interesting because short films are such an interesting game.
Like, yeah,
there's not like as much of a commercial market for, although there's a growing one. It's not as much, and for me, it's a stepping stool to getting to a place where I can make features.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been my goal.
I think it's really good though, because it's a great stepping stone because it shows people your ability to get to the point, which is, it's hard to get to the point without it feeling really rushed and people being confused about where they are, what's going on, why do we care? So it means that you're getting to like the heart of it effectively and it's resonating with people.
I like that summary. That's spot on.
Thank you. I love short films
because I don't think I'll stop doing them. Like
when
I have a concept that I want to experiment with, like I have two in my brain right now that I really want to do when I have some time, and they're like, part of me is like, should I just go write the feature and go produce that? But then I'm like, no, I want to see how the central kernel plays in a short. And if it catches my attention and other people's attention, then I'm like, oh, then it's a winner. And then I'm more certain about my creative vision because I've seen it executed in small part. You know what I mean?
You can see how it translates. Because a lot of times, things, the way you see them in your head, even with just like normal content creation that doesn't have a lot of moving parts, that doesn't have like visual angles and intrigue and all these other components that come into it.
Yeah.
Things usually don't translate exactly the way that you saw them in your head.
Yeah. And I started in theater. So I started as in live theater. So I was that's a very verbal medium. It's less about, I mean, images matter, but it's just less about images are the central storytelling vehicle. And so I tend to write things that are very verbal.
Yeah, and, you tell.
Yeah. And, you know, I need, it forces me to expand the story in all of the visual ways that it needs and all the cinematic ways that it needs.
Mm-hmm.
And even when I was doing my last short film, which is called The Pulpit Prelude, my producer on it was like, we need more visual elements. And he came up, he and I crafted and came up with all the visual elements we could. And that heightened what the short was. Mm-hmm. And it informed what I ended up doing to the feature in the rewrites. Because it was like, these visual elements actually do tell the story better than all of my words do.
Yeah, sometimes just like a little visual motif throughout can really have like a massive impact, like with Fight Club and the Starbucks.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And with what I do love, though, is I love any writer or producer who has a background in the stage, because I feel that the characters are so like forthright. Like they're just so like right in your face. Whereas people who have a background where they've always been doing film are much more like slow burny, which certainly has its place and I really love it. But you can always tell when someone has a theater background, even with like set design. Like they, you guys, theater kids always gravitate towards very specific like Technicolor kind of set design, I feel.
Yeah. Because you're playing to the back of the house, right? You have to be able to play your acting, your storytelling, your set design to the front row as well as to the last row. And so you can't be as subtle sometimes. You have to be.
Yeah.
Use broader, you know, paint, you know.
Strokes.
That's the word.
Yeah, exactly. You started in theater in Kansas, right?
Yeah.
So what is that like? Because I started in theater in Houston, which is like
A
very different vibe. I actually went to theater school.
Oh, really? In Houston?
Mm-hmm. I went to U of H. And that
I
want to
know more.
Dude, it's a very specific environment, like the theater scene in Houston. And it's like, it's very potent, but it's very specific to Houston. And if you go to like Georgia, they have a really specific theater environment as well. And so when I saw that you had a background in Kansas, I was like, that's interesting. Like, what's the vibe of like the theater like world in Kansas?
First of all, I've seen one show in Texas, I have to say.
Really?
Is the
Alley?
Is the
Yeah, we had a partnership with the Alley Theater.
Oh, really?
They're really good.
Yeah, I saw it so long ago. It was right after college with some of my friends. Theater in Kansas is, honestly, it's great. I think it's going through like a kind of a renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there were several, when I was there, 2010 to 2014, 15. That area. There was like a bunch of theaters, storefronts and smaller theaters, sprouting. And they were helping to support the bigger theaters and helping to give more actors jobs.
That's amazing.
There was a lot more like risky work being done at some of them.
Yeah.
And I got to work at, you know, there was this living room, the Fish Tank Theater. And Spinning Tree Theater. And those are in addition to like our bigger staples, like the Kansas City Repertory Theater, the Coterie Theater, which I, children's theater that I spent a lot of time at. I started my career in children's theater.
That's amazing.
And the Unicorn Theater. I mean, there's a number of them. And because it's Kansas City, you know, they're unlike the rest of Kansas, which is largely white, there's a bit more diversity there. There's a bit more opportunity and desire to do shows for people of color, which is helpful.
And it's super important.
Yeah, it's important and it's growing. And I think it needs to grow more, but I was really glad that I was there when I was there. I still go back and watch shows all the time. I was just back there last week. I watched the show.
That's amazing. I love when people go back, because like, especially to like the black box theaters, there's some really cool shows that do better in a black box theater than in like a huge theater.
I literally just said this to a friend of mine. I was like, I've never watched a show in a small theater and said, this should be in a bigger theater.
Exactly.
But I've often watched shows in big theaters and said, this should be in a smaller theater.
Especially like a two-man. Unless the set is really, really important.
Yeah.
You know, and you have something like really dramatic, like it rotates or something like that. Like Venus in Fur is like the perfect black box
Venus
show.
Venus in Fur, yeah.
And I love that show.
I'm so glad you said that, because I don't want to shit talk, but
you can shit talk.
Whatever. Who's going to listen to this? I saw Venus in Fur at the Goodman Theater in Chicago, which I love the Goodman. I've worked at the Goodman. But they had it in the big theater. I was like, why is it in here? It's like 800 seats.
Yeah.
This thing is so intimate and about the nuances and subtlety. And I was like, put it in somewhere smaller with no more than like 150 people.
You got to be close.
You got to be close.
You got to be close.
See. Yeah.
And it's supposed to feel at times kind of suffocating because it's two people in an audition scenario, something really familiar for you.
Yeah.
And they're in like a New York City audition. So it's a small studio
literally,
space.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's supposed to feel like boxed in and the power dynamics keep switching. So it's supposed to feel like you think you have a leg up and then you want to go back, but there's not room because you're in this tiny area.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
All right. Power dynamics. Okay.
Thank you. Speaking of, you have parents who are Nigerian. You're the first generation after they immigrated, correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
How does that affect your work?
Your research.
Always. I'm very research oriented.
How does it affect my work? I mean, it's in everything. It touches everything I do. Like it's just like, I don't know. It's hand in hand with me. My parents, are incredibly loving and devout, you know, Christians, and you know they love the Midwest, so they're not leaving Kansas, and they raised me with like kind of like equal parts Nigerian, like traditional culture, as well as like Midwestern kindness, evangelical culture.
Right,
and I think in that I always approach characters with a more nice guy mentality, and sometimes I have to switch and find the other side.
Yeah.
and also I think just generally, just like in behaviorisms or mannerisms, like there are certain Nigerian things that like I have to check myself on and remember like, wait a second, you're not that. I'm trying to think of a good example right now. Okay, here's one. We have a lot of respect for our elders.
Right.
Like a ton of respect. Mm-hmm. And like so much so that we like will lay on the ground sometimes in a demonstration of our respect for our elders. And this is a problem in real life too. If I meet someone else who's an elder or who's someone's parent or something like that, I will treat them like damn near like a deity. I will be I will bow to them. I'll kneel to them. If I do that in a character, doing that as like just a Black American character, people are confused.
Yeah,
like, what are you doing?
That doesn't resonate.
It doesn't register. Where did you get this from? Oh, right. I got it from another country. That's why.
But sometimes I don't know. I feel like all of my friends who have Nigerian parents, first of all, like the speech pattern's so eloquent.
Yeah,
I love the compliments from Nigerian parents. Yeah, they're so heartfelt. And yeah, they are poetic. They're really beautifully like structured syntactically. And secondly, like I think there's a lot of immigrant cultures that really value the elders. And so like maybe your character is somebody who is born in America, but like who knows what their background may be. And then sometimes that's up to you to decide.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have a unique perspective.
Yeah, yeah. I like that.
Yeah. So like maybe they wouldn't think of that originally, but that doesn't mean it's not going to add to the character is the thing. Because like, do you know the cartoon show, The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy from Cartoon Network?
No.
It's kind of like it's an older one. It's like about a little boy who's like canonically dumb and a little girl who's super smart, but kind of like evil. And they trap the Grim Reaper. And the Grim Reaper becomes like a father figure for the two of them.
Okay.
And they use his powers to do like a bunch of weird stuff and get into shenanigans or whatever. But the Grim Reaper was supposed to originally be this old British white guy voice, you know, where it was supposed to be classic, like, I'm not going to help you. Mm-hmm. And they had this one voice actor come in and he read the script and he felt like it would make more sense for him to be Jamaican, even though nothing in the script says that. And that's what Cartoon Network ended up going with, because actually it really added to the character, like a lot.
Uh-huh.
Like the character not being Jamaican would be crazy now, looking back on it.
That's great.
Would be crazy. And they ended up changing some of the elements of the plot to make it make sense when they go into Grimm's background and all these other things. And it actually made it really, really interesting. They did a lot of research on like voodoo culture and it was really cool. They had like Papa Legba background stuff. It was cool.
Okay.
They had some cool stuff in there that wouldn't have been there otherwise if that actor didn't take that risk. So that could be true for you too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's factored in. The biggest show that I got to do on TV was called Run the World on Stars. And in that show, I'm playing a Nigerian American, which is the only... Yeah, I believe that's the only time I've ever played Nigerian American on television. And it was cool to like literally just pull from my own life and have immediate access of, I know exactly what the, and he's like, you know, got a similar family to me. It was a little bit overbearing and, but very loving. And he's a family man. And, you know, so anyway, so it was very easy to pull from that Nigerian side. And in fact, I kind of got to be a source for just a little bit of research for them. And like, yes, whether it was pronunciations of certain words or certain names or the type of cloth that the woman who was supposed to be marrying my character is supposed to be wearing, you know.
That's so cool. Cause also, like Nigerian weddings are a big deal.
Oh, they're a big deal.
Yeah.
And so like, I would try to use my mom as a resource, which I've done that before. You know, there's a great American, probably in my opinion, the greatest American play, A Raisin in the Sun, which is August Wilson.
I love A Raisin in the Sun.
I figure you knew it. And there's a Nigerian character in it.
Yeah.
And even though I wasn't playing that character in the play, my friend Rufus was. I was like, Mom, I need you to come in and I need you to give us a home run here and just bring the culture and the knowledge. And she did. And it totally shaped how that part of the story was told. There's no replacement for like authenticity.
Absolutely, of course.
And when we're telling a story that has an authentically Nigerian character or the culture, it's like, I just go straight to the source. I'm like, this is my cheat code and I'm going to use it whenever I can.
I love that for you. Do you feel, this is something we talked about in acting school a lot, and I'm interested to see like what your opinion is because it varies for some people.
Mm.
Do you feel that being a good actor is being closer to being really, really good at lying, or it's placing yourself in someone else's truth?
Oh, this is easy for me. It's the second one.
I think so too.
Because I can't lie. I'm bad at lying.
I'm a bad liar as well.
If I lie, I get caught quickly, and so I don't do it.
Yeah.
I'm not good at lying. So I think it's more like, it's belief. You have to believe.
You have to like kind of have a certain amount of delusion to like put yourself in someone else.
And I know actors get a bad rap. I don't think it's, psychotic.
I don't think so either.
I think it's just you, honestly, it's exercising your empathy muscle.
Yeah.
Because the more you empathize with the character you're playing, no matter whether they're a good guy, quote unquote, bad guy, you know, doing right or wrong, whatever it is, you need to empathize with them in that moment.
Yeah.
And the more you do that, the more you are convincing. And that's not lying. That's just caring. Compassion.
It's like that quote, that's to know your enemy is to love them.
That's beautiful.
Because, you know, if you saw somebody's entire life, which no one ever does, not even ourselves, we don't remember everything. Mm. If you saw somebody live their whole life playing out in real time from like the moment of their birth until the moment that they die, even if they were terrible, you would have such a deep understanding for that person that even if you don't condone any of their actions,
you would sympathize.
You see how they got from A to B. Even if you hate a lot of the things that they did or like totally disagree, you can point to like, but this informed that. And there were all of these other things that went into it. And if they had just taken a left here instead of a right there, things would have been different.
Yeah.
You know?
This, to me, is the power of not just the arts, but of storytelling and of theater and acting in specific, because it is such a breeding ground for that.
Yeah.
Like, it is such a great breeding ground for empathizing beyond what you would normally to somebody whose life is different than yours and led them to becoming someone that you might judge or dislike or...
Mm-hmm.
But if you take the time, if you're forced to take the time as an actor because you're playing the role, or even just witnessing another person playing a role, or just watching a show. This is why this to me is the most important thing about narrative entertainment is you're watching characters. And if you take the time to see how they came to be, if the story is well crafted, you will empathize more with someone that you otherwise would have just judged.
Absolutely.
It's powerful. It's powerful.
It is.
We like to, and maybe we should, like write off what we do as silly or as luxurious. But it's powerfully life-changing. It's powerfully life-changing to be able to see someone that you would hate and empathize with them because you took the time to know their story, to know their life. That's power.
Are you a business owner looking to put your ad on this popular show or any show in the podcast landscape? Leverage the power of audio marketing with Podfrog. Podfrog is a 360 podcast advertising agency with access to more than 100 million of media purchases, upwards of 10,000 shows in the fastest growing space in digital media. More than 500 million listeners are listening now, just waiting to be converted to your customers. And conversion rates tend to outdo that of social media, traditional broadcasting, and PPC marketing. Podfrog helps you with the planning, execution, and monitoring as a one-stop shop for your podcast marketing campaign. The Frog utilizes AI software to give granular data on your impressions, conversions, and target demographics. With pre-negotiated rates with networks and top producers, Podfrog gives you the lowest cost CPM in the industry guaranteed. So if you want to get your brand some exposure to this explosive potential growth vehicle of podcast marketing, email info@pod-frog.com. info@pod-frog.com. Ads on a pod, trust the frog.
It is, and it changes the way that you move through the world. And I think where the idea of it being luxurious comes from is the fact that if you eliminate people's survival needs, like they, like you see this with Nepo babies, for example, if you have all your needs met, what do people do with that free time?
Yeah.
And it's art, which should be something that we love about human beings, is that when given nothing to do, rather than like getting super into like consumption, and some people do that, but what people choose to do is create things, make new things. Yeah. And not everyone's good at it, which is where like a lot of the Nepo babies get in hot water. But I do love that they're trying still. And with content creators in particular, there's like a sort of like complaint people have. Like every time someone hits a million followers, they got to put out a song. Or like they got to make like a movie or something like that. But isn't that so much better than somebody just shoving like weight loss tea down your throat?
Yeah.
I would much rather like a content creator come up and be like, I'm going to make music so that I can, you know, make this financially sustainable now that I'm at another level. I would much rather somebody sell like cool fashion design that maybe I don't like, but like they're doing something, or make a short film that maybe I think sucks, but they loved it, you know, than have to see like a million Amazon ads.
Yeah.
Like, I'll take somebody being bad at art over being good at sales pitches every day.
Yeah. And I agree. And I also think that just like the idea of, it's true. It is a luxury to have enough of your needs met so that you can focus on art.
Mm-hmm.
And just like you said, I think 90% of people, if they had their needs met, they would. And at the same time, that doesn't make it easy.
Absolutely.
It's still hard. And I think that that has to be emphasized too. Like,
it does.
It's a gift to be able to make a life focused on that, but that shit hard.
It's really hard because you have to,
full of rejection.
Yeah, you go losses. You reject a lot, and you also have to be kind of painfully self-aware. Is the thing with good art. I mean, have you seen Baby Reindeer?
No.
Oh, it's so good.
I've heard it.
You would love it as a writer.
Man, I'm so behind.
It's okay. I just watched it 2 days ago, to be fair.
Okay.
But no spoiler review. It is painfully self-aware. The guy who wrote it and produced it is playing himself, and it's his real life. And he's a very sympathetic character, for sure. Like, this is like, it's about like a major trauma he experienced. But he does a lot of bad things in it. Like, he does a lot of things that are like cancelable offenses, to be frank. And he is the one writing it, and it is his life. So a lot of people would feel inclined to sort of edit and like omit or downplay their role, but he doesn't do that. He just acknowledges that he kind of sucked in those moments. And that's much better. Like, I appreciate that a lot more because it shows the potential for growth.
Yeah.
And we're seeing a real media literacy problem in the last like 5 years or so. And I think it's just due to lack of resources with education, to be honest, but that's a whole different subject. But I'm seeing this sort of like growing feeling of people being like, you guys can't like this character. They fucking suck. And you can like a character that sucks as long as they, you know, stop sucking later. But if we're going to have a good character arc, someone has to start somewhere.
Yeah.
Because if they start out super awesome and always doing the right thing always and never misstepping, because like some character arcs start out with them being awesome. And then we watch them just like totally just get knocked off that pedestal, which is just as motivating. But if they don't have anywhere to go, it's flat and it's boring. And then people complain that they're Mary Sue, that they have been epic the whole time.
that media literacy thing is true. Like, there's so many ways in which that's true, and that is a perfect example. Like, it's almost like we've forgotten the point of stories. Like, not everything is supposed to be perfect all the time. But if Twitter gets a hold of 10 seconds or 15 or 30 seconds of a character being an asshole, and then they think that's representative of what an entire show is, or what, you know, or what an entire movement is, or what an entire gender is, whatever it is, it's literally like so easily condemnable based off of lack of context.
Yeah.
And people forget that art is in context, storytelling is in context. And also, you're supposed to like experience. You're supposed to experience the whole of the context.
Exactly, and it's also just something. It's a standard that no one really holds in real life. Of course, people hold their friends and family accountable, especially if they're good people. Mm. But it's not on everything. Is the thing. A lot of these things that characters do that people don't like are actually very small, and in real life would likely go unnoticed. Mm-hmm. But they become exacerbated when they're on the screen, and you get somebody's entire internal monologue backing up and reaffirming this sort of kind of shitty little thing that they did. And of course, I'm not talking about somebody who commits like a major atrocity. Like, I'm not talking about somebody being like actually actively problematic. Mm-hmm. But I often see discourse of like, well, this character got like this girl's number and then he never called her. Like, that feels like shit.
Yeah.
It totally does feel like shit. But if one of your friends was like, oh my God, I just found this phone number in my pocket. I forgot to call this girl. Should I still call her? Half the people at your brunch table would be like, nah, it's been too long. And the other half would be like, sure, just like apologize. Yeah. And it would be a lot more of like a mixed bag.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm thinking of something in specific that I don't want to get in hot water for, but like, in Insecure season one, there's a character named Daniel, played by a friend of mine. And that character, the internet was very split over this moment when Issa's character is like giving him head.
Yeah, I knew this was going to be it.
How did you know? And then, you know, he finishes and he doesn't. If he tries to give a warning, but it's like not enough of one, but she's like deeply offended.
Yeah.
And it to me, I think it's just an interesting moment in the show, but in the internet just like went wild with
really
just
intense,
that.
Yeah.
And I guess that's part of what you want now with a show is you want attention and you want things to become
discourse,
you know, discourse and quotable. But also, I sometimes wonder if it misses the point.
Yeah. And, with that in particular, anytime there's anything that involves like intimacy, it's sort of immediately going to provoke like a strong reaction now. Because with that, there's people who have had that experience and they're like, it felt really bad. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, I don't like that. Like, fuck that guy. And then there's other people who are like, oh, I've had that experience. And, you know, it was just kind of funny. Like, things happen. Mm-hmm. And it's all informed by like what you've gone through personally.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes people forget that like we, with the character, we have to think about what she's going through personally. So if she was offended, she's offended, you know? Mm-hmm. But we also have to think of his perspective. He might be just fucking embarrassed, you know?
Yeah,
like, right. And then apologetic, or maybe he thought it was hot, you know? So there's all these different angles that you can take things. And sometimes with public discourse of fictional characters, people forget that we're supposed to be seeing it through the eyes of the show.
Mm.
And that informs a lot of like, what does the show say?
Yeah.
Does the show think this was right? Does the show think it was wrong? Is the show asking you? In which case, then go for it, you know? Because some shows do ask you. Yeah. But it's interesting because you're a writer. When you're writing, because I've always wondered this, I'm not a good writer at all. Like, I wish that I was. I love reading a good work, but I'm just not good at them. I can't stay sitting down for too long. And honestly, I'm kind of tropey, you know? I read my own work back. I'm like, I wouldn't watch that. you know, so like,
well, that's called first and second draft.
Yeah, I guess. But I'm just like, no. I'm like, what is this? This is like Skins, but shitty. This is terrible. But I always wonder, like, when somebody who's actually like a talented writer that has practiced and has success and has put in the hours, do you think while you're writing, what will people think of this? Or do you try and remain uninhibited?
Inevitably, you think of it. It's not the first thing that I think of, but it does. It will happen at some point. I tend to write, I have like two sides of my writer side. One is just like the funny and the fun and comedies. And then there's like the deeply social justice oriented or critical of institutions. And that side becomes more self-conscious about the very power of those institutions and how the people in them will respond. I made a short film called On Sight years ago, and it was about police brutality at the time of Mike Brown and Trayvon Martin. And that I honestly had to start thinking about if this is very, very successful, because this is at a time before it was a big part of entertainment now. Like, entertainment has latched onto that topic and is willing to discuss it.
Entertainment has decided it's okay.
It's okay now.
Yeah.
But in 2013, 2014, 15, when we were talking about it, it's like, we don't like anybody challenging the propaganda we have on TV. These institutions are so treasured to us. How dare you?
Yeah.
And I felt that in the Q&As and in the talkbacks after doing screenings of that film. And so I really became aware. I was already aware when I was writing it, while we were chanting in the streets, Black Lives Matter. And then I was aware again while we were making it. And then I was aware as the Q&As were going on. And I was aware of my family and the people around me. And I was like, I hope that I don't jeopardize anybody who sees the who is nearby, anybody who sees this and feels a kind of way about it. So in that context is maybe the most that I think about what people will think of it in a worrisome kind of way.
Right.
Otherwise, I'm usually thinking in a good way.
Yeah.
Or just a constructive criticism, like, will people understand this plot?
Yeah, will this land?
Will this land? Will this character arc be clear?
Right.
Is it too on the nose or is it too nuanced?
Too nuanced
and subtle?
Where people are missing it.
Exactly. So that, but I think that's constructive. I think you have to think that
way. Right.
The other stuff is a little scarier, but.
I mean, the thing is, though, with revolutionary media, you have to like walk the line when it comes to like making an impact. Of being like fresh enough and talking about something that has been under discussed enough that people see it and it's jarring, you know?
Yeah.
But with that comes a lot of risk and it's really dangerous and people get upset and not everybody is comfortable with what that makes them feel about themselves.
Yeah.
And that's an unfortunate thing because really anytime I see something and I think, I don't know how I feel about that or I don't know if I like that. For me, that's like an interesting moment with myself where I can explore and be like, and why is that? Is it just because I've never heard of it before and I like knowing shit? Is it because like I disagree? Or is it just because it's making me realize I didn't care about something that is certainly worth caring about? And not everybody is comfortable with introspection.
No. A lot of people just don't like being uncomfortable.
In general.
Don't like their worldview challenged. And they like the world ordered and in certain boxes.
Yeah.
It's the same people who will often be very anti any number of progressive movements, whether it's, you know, gay rights or trans rights or whatever, just women empowered. The thing I'm working on right now is a film called The Pulpit, which I told you about the short film. And in that film, we discuss Christian nationalism. Christian nationalism is a longstanding, but right now, especially growing movement of Christianity being merged with this kind of violent patriotic rhetoric that makes it impossible for anyone to be a Christian who's not in a certain box and also makes Christianity very weaponized.
Yeah.
And I grew up Christian. I grew up in
so
evangelical context. It's close to me. It's close to my culture. It's close to my family. It's close to the people that I was raised with. And even beyond that, it's, no one is not touched by religion in this country.
Of course.
And religion, just like politics, are the most fierce things that people are protective
of. Yeah, it's people's faith.
It's
their faith. It's what grounds them to their
and
reality.
And for many of them, it's their identity.
Yeah.
And their identity is not separate from their faith. Mm-hmm. They sometimes don't know how to define themselves outside of their faith, which is all well and good until someone says, hey, your faith is doing something dangerous. Mm-hmm. Your religion, the institution that you are aligning with is doing something dangerous. Mm-hmm. Maybe not your personal faith, but your religion is. And they can't, they get too uncomfortable. They can't handle that inquiry. And then they feel like you're attacking their identity, their personality.
Yeah.
And it's not. I love Christians. I love Christianity when practiced with the kind of love and inclusion that I think Jesus intended.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't even realize how they themselves are being politicized and kind of drug or seduced into, mm-hmm. you know, being a weapon, being an arm of a political agenda.
Yeah.
And it's that's what it is. And it's happening everywhere.
It is. And for me, a lot of my content is like history based. And I also, I didn't grow up like super religious. It was more my extended family. But my great aunts were nuns in the Vatican for my whole childhood. So like I certainly have a grip on Catholicism, you know. But for them, they didn't really, shockingly for a lot of people, they didn't really mind how invested or not invested I was as a child. Mm-hmm. You know, they wanted me to give it a chance.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people assume like nuns in the Vatican speaking Italian and stuff are going to be really, really strict. And in some ways they were, like they'd make you like spit out your gum and stuff. But like in a lot of ways, like with big like hot button issues, a lot more relaxed, a lot more progressive than you would think.
I love that.
And in America in particular, being Christian in America used to be sort of taboo, actually, just a couple generations back. Mm. And when you look at like the aggression towards Italian Americans and Irish Americans, a lot of that actually had less to do with like what countries they were coming from, though there was certainly a xenophobic angle, and a lot more to do with like the strong Catholic faith that they were holding on to.
Mm.
And especially elites in New York, they had their own branches that they were going off of. And, you know, a lot of people who are outside of these religious groups are like, one branch, another branch, what's the difference? But if you're in it, there's a lot of big differences and it matters a ton to you. And so the way that, like, the fundamentalist Christian movement has exploded, because it really has exploded in the last couple of generations, the next generation will have no idea that it hasn't always been this way, which is really like it's fascinating. It's also like a problem in a lot of ways, because it's sort of being derailed in unfortunate directions for sure.
Yeah, it's creating a narrative that will kind of redouble down on the idea that like, oh, this is a Christian nation and this is, and we have never had any other shades or colors, and that it's okay to be kind of exclusionary
And it's totally not. And also, the United States, every couple of years I bring this up on TikTok and people get mad at me, but the founding fathers were deists.
Right, right.
They were deists.
Yeah.
And so we weren't founded on any particular religion, but were we to be founded on a religion, crowdsource-wise, it would have been deism.
Yeah.
And we're clearly not a deist country.
Multiple gods and
yeah,
stuff like that.
A belief in the fact that gods exist. And it's much more subjective and a lot less rigid than people would expect it to
and
be.
And despite all of that, the whole point
was to flee
religious persecution
oppression,
and the idea that it should be one over the other. So there's, in so many ways, the people who peddle that rhetoric are just in the in the face of the obvious Constitution.
Yeah, like the foundation of our country. And it's also interesting because we're seeing a very big rise in Mormonism as well.
Mm.
And actually, one of the most like aggressive, one of the most aggressive massacres on American soil ever was against the Mormons.
Wow.
And it's a great contributor to why Mormonism is so secretive.
Mm.
Because a part of their lore, to be real, is that they were like literally attacked by the government via militia. And so because of that, that's why you see so many fundamentalist branches off of Mormonism, because they felt like culturally they had to protect themselves, keep the community closed.
Mm.
And when you have a closed community, it makes it a lot easier for people to start doing things that they shouldn't be doing and aren't aligned with like the original intentions of that group.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing now is we're seeing that happen with Christian fundamentalism, but the closed group is the borders of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing a rise in nationalism alongside it as a result.
Yep.
And so I love that you're taking that on in your work, because art needs to reflect the times. And there's been a lot of complaints with writers not putting out work that people feel compelled by, and like projects not getting the funding that they need, and music being kind of boring until this rap beef, which has actually been very entertaining.
It's been very entertaining.
It's been good. But, you know, like, it's because people have been complaining that art hasn't been reflecting the times. And so what you're doing and the risk that you're taking, even though it's scary, it should be scary, because if you have something to say, you know, you're not really saying much of anything if everybody's going, yes, I agree.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not drawn to that. Like, as a producer, writer, like, that's not in my head. If it already exists, then why would I make it?
Right.
If there's some version of it that already exists, then why would I make it? They probably made it well. They probably made it better. I only want to make something that I haven't seen before, which maybe a lot of artists say that, but on this angle, when it comes to like dramatic work and the social justice stuff that I'm interested in, it's like, okay, what is happening in culture? What is happening right now in society that isn't being talked about? What's the angle to which people can learn from and empathize more about? And that was what that police brutality film On Sight did. And that's what I hope The Pulpit does, is it educates as much as it entertains. And not everybody likes that, you know. I know a lot of people just want popcorn movies, and there's nothing wrong with that.
But there's also plenty of popcorn movies.
And there's plenty of those going on.
So they can watch them. Like, not everyone has to watch Margaret Atwood, you
know? I love, there's a term, I can't remember who taught it to me years ago, but edutainment.
Edutainment? That is a really good term. Oh, yeah. I like that too.
Yeah.
I think there's certainly like a place for like platforming something that's become more mainstream, but is still like on the edge. I think Beyonce does a really good job of that. Mm-hmm. She tends to make albums about really hot button issues. Not when she's like making it, is it still like not edgy? But by the time it comes out, usually it's been more like socially accepted. And I think people kind of criticize her for that a lot, where they criticize her for playing it safe. Mm. But when you have such like a wide reach, such like a broad impact, I think it actually really helps to sort of cement these ideas that people are just starting to accept in the way that artists like that do. So like, I think we can't undervalue something like that just because it's not cutting edge.
I agree.
But when it comes to people who are making those cutting edge projects, you don't get to like the Beyonce album On a Topic without everybody making the short films and the albums and the mixtapes. And
she's still cutting edge to somebody.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Plenty of people who...
She's talking to the globe.
Yeah.
So like, maybe like Twitter has come to a unanimous decision that like it's socially acceptable, but that's also not everywhere, you know?
And right now, the latest one, which should have been the easiest one, she makes a country album. Is she allowed to be called a country artist?
And yes, she is.
And yes, she is.
She of course is.
This is not cutting edge. And yet it's cutting edge to so many people.
Exactly.
That a black woman.
They're upset.
A black woman who is from the South.
She's from Houston.
And a black woman who has done hip hop and R&B. Is she allowed? And yet we know that answer is obviously yes, but that's cutting edge
information. And I hope she does it from now on.
Yeah.
Because that's the other thing. Like, I love Beyonce's like hip hop. I love when she dipped into rap. I think she was doing a lot of really cool stuff. Mm-hmm. I love when she even got like a little trill with that like Migos song.
Mm-hmm.
But I would love for her to be country from now till forever. Because you know what country music has on lock? And I'm not even like a particularly big country fan, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But I love Beyonce's country album. Mm-hmm. What country music has on lock is most other areas in music, women age out very early.
Mm.
And country music, no, they don't.
That's cool.
Dolly Parton is still performing halftime shows.
That's cool.
And Beyonce deserves to be able to do her performances till she freaking dies if she wants.
What if that's the long view? What if she's like, I know that there's a chance that I might age out of what hip-hop and R&B will allow right
now.
So let me shift.
I think that's exactly what she did.
Have country on the back burner. That's cool.
And I respect it. I respect the strategy because her last album, she put that out. She knows her core audience. She said, they're going to play this at drag shows and it's going to eat.
Yeah.
But that's also not for everybody. So people who aren't in those environments, people who aren't like into that kind of art, they were like, oh, she's falling off. And it's like, no, she isn't. She actually did exactly what she was trying to do, like perfectly. It's just not for you, which is fine.
What a genre bender.
Right? Incredible. But like country music, she can do that forever. And you know what? Especially with how people reacted, I think she will.
Yeah.
Because if she does more country albums than hip hop albums, now what?
Yeah.
Now, which one is she?
Yeah, yeah.
I think she's going to do it. And I
dare
love
you
it.
To keep me off that billboard.
I dare you to keep me off there. And a lot of people were upset saying things like, you know, there's other black country artists, blah, blah, blah. Correct.
Yeah.
What's the, yeah, there has to be one at a time.
Yeah, yeah. That's the whole black problem in and of itself.
Exactly.
Cultural problem about black artists that is forever. The tokenism of if one person is through the door, there's no space for somebody else.
And it's like, no way.
We already got our black person, and it's not cool.
It's not cool. Ridiculous. And so I love everything she's doing with that, and I hope she does it forever.
Yeah.
People will be furious, and I love that. And like, I'm from Beyonce's Texas, you know, so like, I'll always support the artistry. You know, she's good. And U of H is in the third ward, right by where she grew up.
Oh, wow.
You know, so you can go see her house.
Oh, really?
It's like sort of near my old apartment.
That's cool.
I'm not even like in the beehive. Yeah, of course. You got it while you're there. There's only so many things in the third ward when you first get there that everyone's like, you got to go see this. And that's one of them.
I found myself at a country... at a country bar the other night. It was crazy. I was in Texas. I was visiting people, and I found myself at this, like, you know, line dance bar.
Oh, yeah.
I've never been there
before.
Vibe's
incredible.
The vibe was, it was such a cultural immersion. But the thought that I had was, I was like, I wonder if they would play Beyonce's album here.
And you know what?
And I was like, they won't.
Not this year. Maybe 2 years from now. Mm. Maybe 2 years from now.
There was like one or two black girls in there. I was like, I bet they'd appreciate that.
They would. I would.
Yeah.
I would request it. Mm. What's crazy about the line dancing stuff is they'll eat your ass up in there, man. Like, they're good. Like, you would think like everyone's doing the same dance. You can only get so good. Incorrect.
No.
There are some stars in that line.
Yeah, yeah.
You can see who is better by a lot.
I saw some, and I was like, yo, they not playing around.
That's what I'm saying. I went to, there's this place in Austin that's like iconic. It's like an old dance hall from like the beginning of time, practically. And it's in downtown Austin. It's called the Broken Spoke. And I like tourists always want to go there, but every time you go in there, it's just like a bunch of 80-year-olds two-stepping. And they're so good. And I went, and it was like a third date with like my boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And we thought we were going to like kill it in there because like we're good at dancing together. Oh my God. It was the most humbling experience of my life.
You got stomped on.
They were absolutely wrecking. Like, and for reference, like my boyfriend's in the NFL. He knows how to move.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
He's good at dancing. He knows his body. He can lift me up. We can do tricks, you know? No, man. There were like 80-year-olds with arthritis and stenosis flipping each other in the air in ways that I didn't know human beings could move. And I was like, we got to get out of here. Like,
hey, can I ask a random question, changing subjects? But just because I don't know as much about you as you've done incredible research on me.
Thank you.
What did you ever do improv comedy?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. My
I can feel it.
My acting teacher told me I was not uh-oh. Funny on a script, but I was funny in improv.
I don't like that.
She was like, you're only funny reactionary, like, comedy. And I was like, whatever, Carol, you're not funny, period. You know, it's going to be funny when you stop taking your meds. And she was like, see, that was funny, but when I give you a script, you suck. And I was
did
like,
did you agree with her?
No. I was like, your scripts are, are slapstick. Like, some people are really good at slapstick, but that's so specific.
Maybe it's because I don't want to do Noel Coward right now, or maybe it's because I'm not into feeling, what is it? Neil Simon at this particular moment. Maybe my modern humor is different.
I'm not a physical funny. I'm like someone says something and then I am making it funny. You know, like she was actually a really good acting teacher, but she was like whack for that, where I was like, whatever, I don't even care. Like, I was like, and then went home and cried, and I was like, I care about that. But
I ask because I could just, you're so quick with it. I'm like, I could tell. Thank very witty.
Thank you. You're very witty too. You're going to go very far, I believe.
You know, thank you. And I will say I was on improv teams. I was usually the least funny person on the improv team.
That's a great place to be though.
But I wasn't mad about it because I still felt like it elevated me and I learned the most there. And I would usually hold things down emotionally, and the other guys would be the hilarious factor.
Yeah, you're like the straight man.
I would, often. Yeah. Not always. I mean, I got some licks in, but you know.
But that's good, though. It's sort of like how ideally, you always want to be the dumbest person in the room because you have the most to gain.
I was
so really the smartest.
I literally, these are guys I went to college with. Like, they were the people who I'm like, they taught me how to be funny.
Hell yeah, dude.
Yeah.
Right. Is there anything you need to plug? Any social media accounts? Any further progress?
Oh, good point. I mean, yeah, you can follow me at Tosin More and Follow on IG. That's where I'm spending most of my time. But right now, go visit thepulpitfilm.com and see what we're working on. We're in a fundraising stage right now, and that's always the heavy lifting part of independent filmmaking. And but it's great. And go check that out and check me out and hit subscribe or whatever button we put on there.
Hell yeah.
Stay tuned.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on the show. This was so fun.
A pleasure. Thank you for
having me. I can't wait
me.
To see your future projects. I'm really excited.
I can't wait to see you start an improv team so we can...
Dude, let's start one so together. Days at day.
Days at day. I love it.
It's a terrible name. Don't give me that.
Think about it.
You're the writer.
With a good one. Days are us? What the hell? No.
It's hard.
Think of something.
Pushing up daisies because we're dying out here.
Ooh, there's something there. Pushing up daisies because we're dying. There's something in there. And it could be self-referential.
It could.
Well, that's funny.
It could. If we bomb, end of days.
End of days. Look, you've got them on tap. You've got them
there's
on tap.
There's only so many daisy-related puns, though. So to be fair.
What's the last name is Foco?
Yeah.
Foco me. Let's just call it Foco me comedy and see if anyone gets that.
It would work. I'm into it. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I ain't never seen you, that's something.